资料，仅供沪江研友内部交流，禁止用于商业目的。
Number 15. You hear talk about a university's library. Although our university is a comparatively small one, it has always attempted to ensure that it possesses a library stock of exceptionally high quality in all the subject fields which are studied here. This policy is reflected in the richness of the library stock, which now stands at over 900,000 volumes, with over 4,500 periodical titles.And the quality of the library's reference collections particularly high, and many valuable reference works which other academic libraries lack are available here. Subscriptions are also maintained to such expensive publications as the three citation indexes in science, social science, and arts. The university library is situated in the middle of the university campus.The library building, which won an award from the Royal Institute of British Architects, was officially opened in September 1975. Its most striking external feature is the solar heat reflecting tinted glass, which covers the whole of two side sand parts of a third. Inside the building, there is space for 800 readers, and we have two branch libraries, the Clinical Science Library in the Royal Infirmary,containing the collections in clinical medicine, and the School of Education Library, which contains the main education collection. Anyone has open access to library materials, and services are free to all the students and staff of the university. You can study in the library, but if you want to borrow books, you must join. Just go to the main desk near the entrance on the ground floor and fill in the form.During term time, the library is open on weekdays from 9 in the morning until 9 in the evening, except on Friday when we close at 5:30. On Saturday, it stays open from 9 in the morning to 5 in the evening. We don't open on Sundays, and our opening hours during the vacation vary, so ask the staff for details.
Part B. Directions. You will hear the same talks and conversations.Complete the sentences or answer the questions while you listen. There's not more than three words for each answer. You will hear each recording twice. You will be given some time to read the questions before each recording begins.
Number one. You will hear a talk about the island of Malta. Today, I'd like to let you know an ideal place for English learning, the island of Malta. Malta is a surprise.An English island in the middle of the Mediterranean. The islands of Malta are a fascinating mixture of cultures and influences. The architecture of the capital is influenced by the classical styles of Italy, which lies 90 kilometers to the north, while many of the place names are Arabic in origin. North Africa is only 230 kilometers to the south. Yet, the Maltese people speak English and are very proud of their long connection with Britain.In recent years, Malta has become a very popular destination for English language learners who want to combine an English course with a holiday in the sun. Malta now has 24 schools licensed by the Ministry of Education, and during the summer, students can enroll on part-time courses which offer a half day of lessons and plenty of free time to explore the islands. Today, the people of Malta are happy to welcome all foreign visitors,And during the summer, thousands of tourists visit the islands, mainly from Northern Europe. They come for the guaranteed sunshine and the variety of Maltese life. Maltese food is a delicious mixture of different styles and influences, and fresh fish, caught from the Mediterranean, is always on the menu. After dark, Malta's towns and resorts come to life as people enjoy the cooler evening temperatures. Later still, for the very energetic,There are discos and nightclubs. For learners of English who are serious about their studies, there are also a range of intensive and specialized courses on offer from schools. Malta's winter months are ideal for students who are looking for a quieter atmosphere. There are fewer foreign tourists, so it's easier to meet local people and practice English. Most of all, the sun keeps on shining in Malta during the winter, so learners can still enjoy the warmth and vitality of this Mediterranean jewel.
Number two, you will hear an introduction about the American musician George Gershwin. The American musician George Gershwin once said, "My people are American, my time is today." He believed that music should express the thought and feeling of its own time in history. Gershwin was born in New York City in 1898, the second of four children. As a boy, he was restless, energetic, and stubborn. He did not particularly like school, and he was often in trouble. In 1910, George began to study music with a piano. In 1912, he became the pupil of Charles Hampiger, who recognized George's genius and wished to be the most important influence in his development. Hampiger gave George direction and training, and through Hampiger's influence, George began to pay attention to serious music and to go to concerts. Though his lessons included only classical music, George's own compositions were popular songs. After Hampiger's death in 1918, George began to work with Edward Kyllenyi, a Hungarian musician who became his second most important teacher. Kyllenyi taught him musical theory and how to write for the orchestra. George made an attempt to play the piano on the stage, but this was unsuccessful. In 1919, George published a musical comedy, La La Lucille. In 1924, the now world-famous Rhapsody in Blue was performed for the first time. The concert was a great success and brought wealth and fame to its composer. Gershwin's last serious work was Porgy and Bess, which was regarded as a true American opera. It tells a story about people who seem very real and who are sharing in moments of great emotion. The show ran for 120 performances and was only moderately successful. Gershwin did not live to see the triumph of the work that he considered his best creation. He died in 1937 at the early age of 39. He had brought a new language to serious music in America and had enriched American popular music with many unforgettable melodies.
Number three, you will hear an interview about global warming. Dr. Clark, global warming was the threat of the 1980s, but it seems to have fizzled out of people's minds. Why do you think that is?
Yes, in a way you're right. I think scientists have become occupied with the task of trying to find out whether it is really happening, and if so, whether it's caused by human activity.
A greenhouse effect is, after all, a natural phenomenon.
Yes, as we know, naturally occurring gases float above us, acting as insulators that prevent heat from being radiated into space.
And the fear is that the insulation might get thicker.
Yes, and because of this, the Earth might get warmer.
The latest prediction we've heard is that temperature will increase by about a third of a degree every 10 years. What are your feelings?
Well, this prediction is difficult to make. You see, the global climate is the result of the weather influences. Who is to say that a simple action, such as adding carbon dioxide to the atmosphere, will not have several effects, which might even cancel each other out?
And I understand that the prediction is hard to verify, whatever.
Precisely.
Why is that?
Because the Earth's temperature rises and falls naturally. In fact, the best way of detecting global temperature change is to measure the temperature of the oceans as accurately as possible.
And this avoids the sort of seasonal fluctuations of the temperature of landmass.
Yes, in fact, an understanding of the ocean is crucial to understanding how the global climate works. The ocean transports heat around the globe. It's like a great reservoir of heat. A tiny change in sea surface temperature denotes a huge change in the amount of heat it is storing. Number four. You will hear an extract from a talk about ways to avoid headaches. Hello, welcome to our program. Today's session is on health issues, and this talk is about headaches and how to avoid them. It may surprise you to hear that headaches are often caused by hunger. In fact, one study suggested that 70% of headaches are related to hunger, which makes it the principal cause. The advice is simple. Eat 3 meals a day and try to keep to a fairly regular schedule of meals. People associate noise with headaches, and for most of us, excessive noise creates the conditions for a headache. Very loud noise is unpleasant, and people usually remove themselves from it. Just remember that exposure to too much noise may predispose you to a headache. Of course, we all associate headaches with studying. In fact, the headache probably doesn't come from the studying so much as from being tense. Another thing, it's very important to check that you are working in a good light. It will not actually hurt your eyes to work in a bad light, but it will make you tense. What's more, if you have the book flat on a desk in front of you, it will be harder to read, and you will have to hold your head at an odd angle. It is wise to have a book rest which raises the material you are reading 45 degrees to the desk. This will help reduce your chance of a headache. Try to relax before bed so that you will be relaxed when you try to sleep. A soak in a hot bath may be helpful. It's also important to really sleep when you go to bed. A good mattress is a wise investment for people who want to avoid headaches. In general, try to eat regular meals and avoid tense situations. Be sure you get plenty of exercise. Hopefully your headaches will be greatly reduced. One other thing I should point out, avoid smoky rooms in cars. Such places certainly encourage headaches, and the smoke may be doing you quite serious long-term damage.
Number 5. You'll hear talk about the country of Switzerland. Switzerland is a small country in the middle of Europe, famous for its beautiful scenery, its unique banking facilities, and the excellence of its manufactured products, especially watches and clocks. The country is a federal republic and is officially known as the Swiss Confederation. Its total area is 15,940 square miles, and the population in 1995 was 6,905,000. It is bounded on the north by Germany, on the east by Austria and Liechtenstein, on the south by Italy, and on the west by France. The capital city is Bern. The people of Switzerland fall into four distinct groups, each speaking a separate language and generally following different religious practices: the German Swiss, the French Swiss, the Italian Swiss, and the Rhaeto-Roman Swiss. However, the goodwill that exists among them enables them to live and work together. The statistics show that about 5% of the population was foreign-born. Nevertheless, the existence of these separate groups, as well as the foreign-born population, has not prevented the formation of a type of person that can be recognized as the typical Swiss, rather short, with brown or blonde hair, and dark or gray eyes. The Swiss are known all over the world for their devotion to work, their efficiency, and their keen business sense. They love to travel, and many of them live outside of Switzerland without giving up their Swiss nationality. Now, over 160,000 of them are living abroad, mainly in France, Germany, Italy, and the United States. There are four official languages in Switzerland. German, in the form of the Swiss dialect, is spoken by about 72% of the population and is spreading into the French-speaking areas. French, the next most widely spoken language, is used by about 20%, mostly in the neighborhood of Lake Geneva in the southwestern part of the country and along the French border. Italian is spoken by 6% of the population, almost exclusively in the southeast, next to Italy. Finally, about 1% of the population speak Romansh, a language derived from Latin, like Italian and French, but different from them.
Number 6. You'll hear a conversation about popular music. I heard that one of your greatest hobbies is popular music. I also like popular music, but I don't know much about its historical development. Could you tell me something about it?
Sure. The modern popular song is the end product of a huge industry. Music for entertainment is manufactured, marketed, and consumed just like any other product in present-day society. Just as other industries have developed from small-scale local production and consumption to modern mass production, so has the popular music industry developed. In the medieval times, the only music specially written for entertaining people was provided by wandering minstrels who would perform wherever there was enough prosperity to keep them alive. In the early 1500s, some Italian composers took a form of light-hearted street song, the frittola, and began making it into a musical entertainment more suitable for their rich and cultured patrons. The spectacular success achieved by Italian opera in the 17th century gave popular music a tremendous stimulus. For the first time, music became known amongst a wide range of people in many countries, instead of just locally, as had been the case in the Middle Ages. The two traditions of popular music, music for the stage and sheet music for the home, continued to make great strides in the late 19th century. Both became increasingly commercial.
It is said that the radio had helped popular music sales, isn't it?
Yes, the development of commercial radio expanded the market for pop music as dramatically as records had in the early 20th century. People could buy a radio set and have free entertainment piped into their homes. The programs were paid for by advertising, as this vast capitalist entertainment industry is constantly searching for something new in order to increase its turnover. Its successes reflect to a great degree the changes within society. For instance, the emergence of rock and roll and its hero, Elvis Presley, in the mid-50s gave vigorous expression to the feeling of a new generation of youth. Rock and roll showed record makers that a fortune could be earned simply by appealing to youth. This they have done ever since, and the composition of the top 10 record charts is increasingly determined by the tastes of 13 and 14-year-olds. The Beatles, for example, owed most of their early success to the very young.
Number 7. You will hear a talk about Isaac Asimov. Isaac Asimov was born in the Soviet Union to his great surprise. He moved quickly to correct the situation. When his parents emigrated to the United States, Isaac, 3 years old at the time, stowed away in their baggage. He has been an American citizen since the age of 8. Brought up in Brooklyn and educated in its public schools, he eventually found his way to Columbia University and, over the protests of the school administration, managed to acquire a series of degrees in chemistry, up to and including a PhD. He then went to Boston University and climbed the academic ladder, ignoring all cries of outrage, until he found himself professor of biochemistry. Meanwhile, at the age of 9, he found the love of his life when he discovered his first science fiction magazine. By the time he was 11, he began to write stories, and at 18, he actually worked up the nerve to submit one. It was rejected. After 4 long months of suffering, he sold his first story, and thereafter, he never looked back. In 1941, when he was 21 years old, he wrote the classic short story, Nightfall, and his future was assured. Shortly after that, he had begun writing his robot stories, and shortly after that, he had begun his Foundation series. What was left except quantity? At the present time, he has published over 340 books, distributed through every major division of the Dewey System of Library Classification, and shows no sign of slowing up. He remains as youthful, as lively, and as lovable as ever, and grows more handsome with each year. You can be sure that this is so, since he has written this little essay himself, and his devotion to absolute objectivity is notorious.
Number 8. You will hear a talk about plague. Since the beginning of time, people have been terrified of contagious diseases. Today it is AIDS. Previously it was the plague, cholera, smallpox, and tuberculosis. Tropical countries still suffer an alarming number of plagues, such as sleeping sickness and malaria, for which no complete cure has yet been found and which are often fatal. No sooner does a cure emerge than another strain of the disease appears. The word plague was the name given to any epidemic disease which claimed large numbers of victims. The first recognized plague epidemic occurred in 542. The second epidemic occurred between 1346 and 1353. It started in India, spreading to the Middle East and then Italy. In 5 years it killed 25 million people throughout Europe, a quarter of the population. During the third epidemic in 1894, the plague bacteria of the rat, as well as the human bacteria, was identified in Hong Kong by the Swiss-born French bacteriologist Alexandre Yersin, who had been sent by the Institute of Pasteur to study the disease, which had just broken out in China. In 1898, P.L. Simmons identified the role played by the flea in the transmission of the disease. In 1897, Waldemar Hofkinser developed the first anti-plague vaccine. During the third epidemic, which lasted for 50 years and killed 12 million people in India, between 1898 and 1948, there were only 91 cases recorded in Europe. It was followed by minor epidemics in Algeria in 1930 and 1944. Today the plague is still endemic in several regions throughout the world. The early use of antibiotics as soon as the disease is diagnosed has affected the outcome of the disease, which is no longer necessarily fatal. Despite this, 184 died of the plague in 1988.
Number 9. You will hear a talk about a solar eclipse. On December 25, 2000, many people across North America received a rare Christmas treat when the moon passed in front of the sun, resulting in a partial solar eclipse. Solar eclipses occur when the moon passes between the Earth and the sun, and the moon's shadow covers part of the Earth. And a total solar eclipse takes place when the moon's shadow blocks out the sun entirely. What made this particular solar eclipse unique was that this event has occurred on December 25th only 30 times during the past 5,000 years, the last time in 1954. But people must be exceptionally careful when attempting to view a solar eclipse. Without taking precautionary measures, one can permanently damage the retina of the eye. However, there are several safe methods of witnessing this heavenly marvel. First, you can view a solar eclipse by using eclipse safety glasses for filtering out the sun's harmful rays. They should be used when any part of the sun is visible. Sunglasses can block out some of the sun's ultraviolet rays, but the results can be very deceptive. The eye's natural reaction to this darkened state when wearing sunglasses is to make the pupil larger, which allows in more light and can intensify the damage to your eye. You can watch an eclipse by projecting the sun's image on a piece of paper, either by using a telescope or, easier yet, by creating a pinhole in a piece of paper and viewing the results on another piece of paper, thus called a pinhole projector. Only during a total eclipse, when the sun is completely and briefly covered, can you watch the eclipse without eye protection. Even then, extreme caution should be taken. In case you didn't catch this last spectacular eclipse on December 25, 2000, there's no need to worry. Your grandchildren can record the next eclipse on Christmas in the year 2307, but only if they're visiting the west coast of Africa for the holidays.
Number 10. You'll hear part of a conversation in which two people discuss a holiday plan. Well, Claudia, our first semester at university is almost over. I can't wait for the holidays.
Me too, Toshio. Why don't we go away somewhere far away and forget about lectures and essays and all that hard work?
Sounds good to me. Now, how long will we have before we have to be back here on campus for the next semester?
We've got about 6 weeks, I think.
How about if we go to the coast? It would be great to do some swimming and sunbathing.
The coast would be good, but let's look at our other options. There's the mountains. They're nice and cool at this time of year, and we can do some bushwalking. There's also the desert, which I really enjoyed last year.
What about going to Sydney? I've never been there, and they say it's a great city to visit. Lots of things to do there, I've heard.
I agree Sydney would be good, but there are too many tourists there at this time of year, and I'd rather get away from buildings and cars. There are enough of those around here. I vote for the mountains.
All right, then. Let's do that. Now, we have to decide where we're going to stay and how we're going to get there. Any suggestions?
Well, for places to stay, there are the usual places. Motels, hotels, youth hotels. We could go camping, too.
I'm afraid I'm not a very good camper, Claudia. I tend to feel a bit frightened of sleeping outdoors. And the trouble of building fires and all the insects and...
All right. We'll forget about camping. Although I must admit, it would have been my first choice. So, what should we do?
Well, since neither of us has a lot of money, I don't think a hotel or motel would be possible. How about a youth hotel?
Number 11. You will hear two people talking about hotel services. Well, here's your room, ma'am. After you.
Why, thank you. Oh, what a nice large room.
Oh, yes. All the rooms here at the hotel are quite large, and the rooms on this side of the building have a lovely view. Let me open the drapes for you.
Oh, you're right. The view is wonderful.
Oh, yes, it is. Now, you'll find information about the facilities at the hotel in the directory, which is next to your telephone. The TV is across the room in the corner, and you'll find your radio on the nightstand by the bed.
Fine, I see. Thank you.
Now, in the directory, you'll find phone numbers and information about room service, restaurants, and coffee shops. The two restaurants are on the second floor, and the coffee shop's in the lobby.
Right.
Oh, by the way, we have a lot of nice shops and boutiques here near the hotel, so you can do some shopping.
Oh, that's wonderful. Thank you very much.
Now, there's also a hairdresser and a newsstand just off the lobby to the right of the desk. I think the hairdresser is closed tomorrow on Monday. Would you like me to check and see if the hairdresser is open tomorrow?
Oh, no. That won't be necessary unless you really think I need it.
Oh, no, ma'am. Now, you can call the housekeeper if you need your clothes pressed or your laundry done, and you can call the bell captain if you need something like a taxi or an airport limo. We also have tickets to the theater and sporting events. Of course, we can always help you with your luggage.
Right, I see. Well, actually, there's only one thing I need to know. When is room service available?
Oh, room service is available 24 hours a day here.
Oh, good. Why, thank you very much.
Yes. Now, we have a revolving cocktail lounge on the top floor, and, of course, an Olympic-sized pool and sauna in the basement. The hours, I think, you'll find in the directory there. It's on the last page.
I see. Well, thank you so much. I think I have all done now. I'll be fine.
Oh, yes.
Why don't you take this, just a little something for your trouble?
Oh, thank you. Now listen, you have a pleasant stay.
Thank you.